This is a more or less non-technical talk. This is the how MP3 actually came into existence, and then a little bit about AAC. So basically, this is the story of how I wrote a test program for a new computer that turned into MP3. It's not a joke. But give you a little bit of chronology. In 1976, we had 16 kilohertz sampling rate, 2 to 8-bit ADPCM and analog hardware. This doesn't sound very good, but we had it. I mean, that's basically 32 to 96 kilobits or thereabouts. 1977, we had 32 kilohertz running in ADPCM. I'll talk about the hardware for that in a little bit. It's very thankful that we don't have that kind of hardware anymore. But these were entire boards. You know, that you couldn't have fitted in the same space as the laptop. 1978, we had two-band sub-band coding for 7 kilohertz bandwidth and analog hardware. And then 1979, we had 56 kilobit two-band sub-band coding for commentary speech, which is 7 kilohertz, which is now what's called wideband speech, in digital form. What does it mean? Well, this is the first signal processor I ever built. The A to D was 2 to 8 bits. It was about 6 square inches by half an inch thick and sucked down about 15 watts. And it would give us actually samples at a rate of around 16 kilohertz if you didn't have to feed it into the A to D to complete the loop. If you had to feed it into the A to D to complete the loop, you were going to get 8 or 9 kilohertz if you were lucky and everything was timed right and the TTL hardware was fast enough. And the resistors and capacitors are exactly that. That's a DPCM. This is one of the first attempts at a speech coder. The stuff you have in your cell phone is a direct lineal descendant of this, but it's a lot more complicated and a lot smaller hardware. All in all, this made 32 kilobit speech that sounded a little better than your cell phone, but not as good as a regular phone, in hardware that sucked down about 50 watts and took up a good size, half of a desk. Well, the next trick, we put in an analog divider. Anybody here remember the days of analog dividers? Anybody old enough to actually have to use them? Oh, you're very lucky then. And an analog multiplier, so now we could change the step size and the quantizer. We could basically ramp the gain up and down and up and down according to some equation. You don't care about the equation so much. Suffice to say that we're talking about great big boards, we're talking about lots of resistors, and we're talking about hardware that every time you breathed on it would go out of spec. And that was for the ones that were very carefully designed. If you weren't really careful about your thermal design, they wouldn't stay stable long enough to adjust it so it would work. Did I mention, by the way, are a little hard to use? And then we built the subband coders using analog filters. Now, imagine a four-band subband coder with sixth-order elliptics for each half of the band. So it's 12th-order filters, six second-order sections per band. So you have 24 second-order sections for the encoder and another 24 second-order sections for the decoder. And now I dare you to think about the number of resistors and capacitors involved, because you can get a good second-order section down to about six capacitors if you really want it to be stable and clean, and you can get it down to about 10 resistors and six capacitors and three op amps. So do the math. I'm not going to do it. I did it once. I can say I did it. They worked amazingly, and it demonstrated that all this subband coding actually had a practical use. And it had more resistors, more capacitors. We had a spectrum analyzer sitting next to it and a white noise generator sitting next to it, because before you demonstrated it, you turned it on and you adjusted the filters. Did I mention all the little pots and the little screwdriver? You know, the little green screwdrivers? We had one on a tether attached to the box because you really needed it. That was interesting hardware to build. Of course, then, what's going on here? The reason people did subband coders was interesting. They thought if you break things up into frequency bands, you can limit the spread of the quantization noise. And this is basically, if you're linear algebra type diagonalization, or you're finding some sort of basis vectors. And that was a thought that this was all mathematical and all doing least mean squares. And the first thing you found out is it worked, but it worked a lot better than it should have. And that was actually a hint that took a few years to figure out what the hint was telling us, but that worked a lot better than it should have because you improved the signal-to-noise ratio a couple of dB, and it sounded a lot better, like more than a couple dB better. So what was going on, we'll get to in a minute. And then we have this commentary grade coder. First, it was implemented in analog hardware, and it had 28th order filters for the bandpass filter and 14th order filter for the low-pass filter, and you have to have one of those in the encoder and one of those in the decoder, and I think you can already figure out what this looks like. Well, this time now we had actually integrated circuits that were second-order sections. So you only needed like 8 resistors to make the thing, each section work. So it was a lot smaller. It worked. We had the screwdriver fastened to it too. It was a lot better though, because now all the op amps were on one chip and all the resistors were on one chip, so you could actually get some temperature compensation. Amazing how that works. It worked. It required the usual constant adjustment. And so then Esteban and Galán came up with this thing called a quadrature mirror filter. It's purely a digital process. When you do a band split into two bands with the quadrature mirror filter and you don't do any processing, it cancels the aliasing. And no, we didn't do anything like that in the analog filters. Good luck getting them to have the right characteristics. There were no nice filter design methods to do this. So I took a great big hammer, which is to say, it was for those days a fast computer, and ran it for weeks, and I designed a bunch of filters that I put into a paper, because it took literally 6 months to calculate them all. And despite the fact I'm one of the guys that invented NP3 and the guy that invented most of AAC, this is still my most cited paper, because it actually had the filter coefficients in it, and they have spread remarkably. It's sort of ironic.
Define right, though.
Well, define right. It's an indeterminate optimization problem, so how do you define right? The way they were entered into the paper was using text editor to copy the filters out of the filter coefficients out of a file. You don't think we entered all those 10-digit numbers by ourselves. So we did in 1979-1980. We did another version of the subband coder, and then we did a design for a 6-band quasi-octave band subband coder. But guess what? The computer, now we're doing this digitally, remember, doesn't have enough memory to do it. You couldn't fit it in to a 32 kilobyte memory. So 81 and 82, we did hardware of the 2-band. And it worked really great for most music, 56 kilobits for 7 kilohertz bandwidth. It sounds easy today, but it wasn't then. And it sounded really good, and then we put in a female vocalist with no backup. Oh, what was that? Quick, turn it off. Is it broken? Well, no, it wasn't broken. It was adapting properly. The signal-to-noise ratio was actually better than you expected, and it sounded terrible. So I sat next to a guy who did a lot of psychoacoustics. I said, "Hey, what's going on here?" He said, "Oh, masking spreads upward." Now, what this means is it means if you have a signal at 100 hertz, it masks the signal at 200 hertz. If you have a signal at 200 hertz, it doesn't mask anything at 100 hertz. So when you have Joan Baez and a cut from Diamonds and Rust singing more or less a cappella, and the first energy is at about 500 hertz, that space from the low end of your system to 500 hertz has absolutely no masking. And the signal-to-noise ratio of 20 dB, which was more than good enough for the male vocalist that had energy down to 100 hertz, simply doesn't cut it. So now this was the first hint. You know, we have to worry about perception here. What's going on here? So what was going on? Well, you had the low-frequency energy, mass high-frequency noise, no problem. And especially since most low-frequency signals tend to have a spectrum that rolls off fairly slowly, it really wasn't a problem. We did find... Sorry. We did find a couple of signals that, in fact, did break it, a couple of low-frequency signals, like it did something interesting to the beginning. It was also Sprach Zarathustra. It made a nice, very carefully tuned romantic pipe, which is not my favorite kind of organ, but the kind it was recorded on, sound more like a Baroque pipe because it had all sorts of wind noise, except it wasn't adding wind noise. You heard the quantization noise. But since it was modulated at the same rate as the bass, it sounded pretty good. It just changed one kind of organ into another kind of organ. But when you had no low-frequency energy and you had somebody singing a high C, not so good. So, well, now we learn all about upward spread of masking in a real big hurry. So now what? Well, 1984, 1985, the very first Alliant FX8 computer landed on our doorstep. And there's some other things involved here. I hung out a lot with the Unix group, and even though we had all the data general machines in the signal processing group, because they were about four times as fast for the floating point. And, well, now we had this great big Thunder Lizard. It was a whole 80 megaflops, which was a factor of 60 faster than the previous machine, which is a big step. And it also had 2 megabytes. Can you imagine that? 2 megabytes of memory. And we had enough memory space to try this. And I was the only guy in the entire department that knew how to use Unix. So they pointed at it and said, "You, try to break it." So I sat down. I took the original model from Holotall and Schroeder that tried the whole masking approach on speech, and took their model and then added understanding of tone masking noise versus noise masking tone, which is something they left out. And I wrote a test program. Now, I did, in fact, break the compiler repeatedly, but that was part of the job. Eventually, I had a program running, and I said, "Really? I can code 32 kilohertz sampling rate music in under 128 kilobits per second? That can't work." So I'll tell you how we played it back in a minute, but yes, it did work. So anyhow, just to explain here, the tone masking noise, noise masking tone thing, noise masks anything in the frequency range around it very well. Tones don't. Now, what happened with the Holotall and Schroeder paper is you have speech is mostly either voiced or unvoiced. Voiced speech acts like something that's about halfway between tonal and noise-like, which means you need about a 15 dB signal-to-noise ratio. The fricative parts, the unvoiced parts of speech, act more like noise, and they need about a 5 dB signal-to-noise ratio. Now, it turns out that speech coders use a lot of LPC gain, and there's about a 10 dB difference in LPC gain between the voiced and the unvoiced. So what happens is the compensation for tone versus noise happens automatically in an LPC coder. You don't have to do anything. So when you build a fancy coder taking into account all of the masking, it works exactly the same as the original coder because it just happens automatically. Question? Stands for linear predictive coding, which is in it's a linear predictive coding coder, but whatever. Or it's LPC, you know, you could, but most people don't know that LPC is a coder. It's basically if you the slowest version. Have you ever heard some of the really low speech coders like the vocoders for secure stuff? That's LPC-10, which is a 2.4 kilobit system. That's the one that sounds like this. I mean, it basically abstracts the vocal tract more and more and more as you get down in rate. And the linear prediction means that they use a set of recursive filters to model your vocal tract, and then they drive it with some sort of error signal. Anyhow, the most useful bit of information was finding out about the asymmetry between tone masking noise and noise masking tone. This is something it probably could have only ever done at Bell Labs because I had the psychoacoustics guy sitting on one side of me, the Unix guy sitting down the hall, and the rest of the signal processing people sitting across the hall. So that's how it all got put together. The moral of the story, well, 15 dB in noise masking tone performance is ludicrous. You need about 5.5 dB. 30 dB for tone masking noise is about right. And the speech is about halfway. You just get this nice fit. It just adapts like you would want it to. And when you try all the fancy psychoacoustic models on speech, it doesn't do anything because it does what the coder is going to do anyhow. But this does not happen, unfortunately, in audio coding because, I mean, looking at the the predictive model for, say, a drum has nothing to do with the predictive model for a voice. Music has, in mathematical terms, music occupies a much wider space than a voice. Back to the test program. Well, I wrote, the first thing I wrote is something called a perceptual noise insertion. How do you test your model? Well, you take some music, you inject noise at what you think the threshold is, and you listen to it. Okay, that seems to be pretty much right, and I'll play an example of that in a minute. Perceptual entropy. So how much information do we actually have here? How small can we shrink this? Actually figure out the quantization levels and the number of bits required to represent this signal. And then finally, make it into a transform coder. And we did 32 kilohertz samples, 32 kilohertz sampling rate, and why it's 32 instead of 44 we'll get to in a minute. And we did 128 kilobit per second. And it was an overlapped FFT bank. The MDCT paper hadn't been written yet, so I didn't use that. Well, it was a long block. It had quite a bit of pre-echo, but we never noticed the pre-echo for a reason I'll get to. And, well, for anything but some special signals like castanets, it was just a couple orders of magnitude better as far as your ear was concerned than anything, even the 192 kilobit six-band coder. It just blew the socks off all the other coders we had. Where did I get the data? This is why the testing was incomplete. Well, I'll just describe what you did. You took an LP, you transcribed it to a high-quality cassette at home, since we didn't have an LP at work. You took a high-quality cassette at work, and you started up on a blank disk. You started up the data general machine and scrolled a whole 10 seconds onto the disk after about half an hour of setup. Then you wrote that whole 10 seconds to a tape, an 800 DPI tape. You took the tape off of that machine, you walked down the hall, you put the tape on the Alliant, you read the tape in raw format, then ran a program to turn the raw format back into PCM. That's how you got data in. There was no digital audio those days. How did you get data back out? Well, you take the same thing and flip it. Did it work right? About one out of four times. You couldn't tell if you had a hit in a real-time performance until you actually took it one way, took it back the other way, and then listened to it. There was no way to tell if it worked. No sign of failure until you went one way, then the other way. This was fun. This is why we had a very small test suite, because it took a couple of weeks to get four 10-second clips. And needless to say, when CDs arrived, that made life a whole lot easier. So what happened? 86, we had the first informal listening tests, and we had the FX8, not F8X. We had it working very nicely. And in 87 and 88, I worked on image coding and video coding because I couldn't publish this because they didn't want to apply for the patent because they didn't think it had any commercial importance. But, okay, well, let me publish it. Oh, no, you can't publish it either because it might have some value. But you said it had no value, so you want to apply for the patent. Well, yes, but it might. Right. If you have a sense of having gone around in a circle there a couple of times, I went around in the circle more than a couple of times. Finally, 1988, they filed the patent, published it at ICASP. And this is in a poster session. I'm sitting there on a poster, and the next poster is a paper by Karl-Heinz Brandenburg and Heinz Gerhauser, with Heinz Gerhauser standing in front of it. I put up my poster. He put up his poster. He read my poster. I read his poster. We could have swapped posters. I mean, the only difference was the editor's names. I mean, he used an MDCT. He had more of a least mean squares approach. I had the perceptual approach, but we looked at each other's papers. We could understand them without really having to think. So this, in a way, is really how MP3 got started because, you know, we invited the various bosses to come and look at these two papers, and they decided maybe we should work together. So what about the test program? Well, there are some good things about this test program. You could write a statement like this. You know, it looks a lot like MATLAB. This will do large vector operations in one line of code. That calculates a spectral flatness measure in one line of code. But That's the good news. The bad news is it has no pointers, no malloc, no way to allocate memory on the fly. And encoders, you have to do things like Huffman coding. Now, try to figure out how to do a Huffman coding with no pointers and no malloc. Anybody want to try to do that? There's some programmers in this room. I know there's some programmers in this room. You want to try it? I don't hear any. So it was entertaining, but at least we got the thing flying. The Huffman code was about three times the code of the signal processing part, of course. Use fixed-size arrays, and you put indices in the arrays. Disgusting. Anyhow, that's how perceptual coding got started. So what's the deal? What's the big deal? Well, now what I'm going to do is you're going to lose the thing on the screen, I think, because I don't think I can put... I might be able to reduce this without actually losing what's on the screen. We'll try. Nope, can't do it. So now I'm going to play you a couple of tracks. You know, Rick, we never checked levels, so be ready. Okay, now what I'm going to do is I'm going to play you a couple of things. I'm going to play the original track. Now, this is captured in pseudo 16-bit and 12-bit floating point, which is to say that the A to D moved the 12 bits it had up and down. This was originally sampled at 32 kilohertz because that was the fastest A to D you could buy. At least it did more than 4 bits. So, this is the original.
Awa, 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 utwayele ile ganja. Awa, awa, fote sensuweni za namja. Awa, awa, sibona kwenze ganja. Awa.
And that is 1/4 of the material that MP3 was invented on. And now what we did is I took the perceptual noise insertion that I talked about a minute ago and I ran it on this clip. And this is what it sounds like with 13.6 dB signal-to-noise ratio. Now, John, what do you think of 13.6 dB signal-to-noise ratio? Sounds sort of bad?
Sounds a touch bit low.
Well, listen.
Awa, 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 utwayele ile ganja. Awa, awa, fote sensuweni za namhla. Awa, awa, sibona kwenzeka ganja. Awa.
The bad news is you can't tell the difference. The good news is you have to be in a good room and do an ABX test to be able to tell the difference. Now, what happens if, say you do 13.6 dB signal-to-noise ratio with sample-modulated white noise?
Awa, 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 utwayele ile ganja. Awa, awa, fote sensuweni za namhla. Awa, awa, sibona kwenzeka ganja. Awa.
Now, those things do have the same signal-to-noise ratio to about 5 decimal places because I generated the one with the white noise in MATLAB and adjusted it until they matched for the first 5 decimal places. And so it gives you a hint of just how much you can hide under the perception. Now, give you an idea of why that works, well, I'm going to play the difference here. This is the white noise difference. Now, you notice how it seemed to acquire a tonal character once in a while? And the reason it acquires a tonal character is because it's still pure white noise, but the spikes in the vocal tract, in their due to their pitch periods, actually create modulation in your ear that actually lets you hear a pitch in a signal that literally has a flat spectrum. So that's why you hear something. But now you want to hear the difference between the original and the perceptually coded one, and now you have this difference.
Awa, awa, awa.
Sorry.
Awa, awa.
That was one off. I'm sorry. This is the difference.
Awa, awa, awa.
And again, that's the sample lock difference. There's no sample shifts or phase shifts or anything here. It's literally the difference. Now, you notice that sounds very much like the original. And what the reason it works is because it's buried under the spectrum in the original, and your ear can't pick it out. Whereas this...
Awa, awa, awa,
you can tell you can pick it out, I think. So that's really what perceptual coding is all about in one slide. And now let me get back to the view graph here. And we should have... So one of them, the one that's perceptually injected, you can tell the difference if you know what to listen to, listen for, especially in the stereo sound field. The other one, I think everybody heard the difference. So that's the difference. I mean, you would need, for that thing, if you used white noise, you need to be down about 45 dB in that particular track if you have sample modulated white noise before it starts to sound transparent. Whereas you need to be down 13.6 if you use the perceptual shape noise. Now, if you think about it, 13.45 minus 13.6 is about 30. I mean, and 30 dB is 5 bits. So if you want to have a flat noise floor, you have to spend 5 more bits per sample to code it. That sort of sums up the problem in a nutshell. So anyhow, we have all this stuff, right? We don't really have a market for this. We don't have a service to do it. So, well, the thought is, so let's send this to a standards body. And MPEG was just starting up. My attitude towards standards bodies is probably standing out right about now. But, like I said, the fun stuff. So, well, we have this great technology. 4 years late, we get to write the paper, but it doesn't make any money, so let's go to the standards organization. Like I said, IO, it's off the disk I go. No, wait, it's off the MPEG-1. Where I show up at MPEG-1 and the folks from the IRT stand up and say, hi, we know everything, nobody else need to apply, everybody else can go home. And then the chair stands up and says, yes, I think that's right. Well, there's 16 proponents. And if you think there's a rodent in the whole thing somewhere, you might be right. So 4 groups we have. We have subband coders, the lot of bands, subband coders, the few bands, transform coders, and something else. I really have forgotten what the 4th category is. It didn't work very well. Basically, you had four people in each group. You had to combine your 4 things, show up in 6 months, and submit it to a subjective test. So off we went. And if it sounds like, it should sound like the start of a horse race. Well, what did we come up with? You notice the busy background is deliberate. You know, there's at least one too many cooks. But we took the perceptual model from our, more or less from my stuff. We took the OCF filter bank, which is Carl Heinz's stuff. We got block switching from the guys at Thomson Brandt. And the other fellow said, you know, that all looks like a good idea. So aspect happened. And, well, you may have detected that from the whole thing that some of the entries in this horse race were not particularly wanted. Well, they changed the interface rules actually a few times, and they changed it a couple weeks before the test. Our interface was a little bit broken, and we threw a whole bunch of jitter into the audio signal, so you can guess what that did to the quality. Well, actually, what happened is, even including the horde of jitter, we won the quality, hands down. There was no question about this. But it was too complicated. They had an estimate from another one of the proponents' chip engineers on what you could make and how you could make different chips and so on. According to that, an aspect encoder would require about a square inch of silicon. And, of course, they said, well, the estimate was silly, of course, but they said, nope, it's too complicated. Go away. Go home. And now we play into the standards part, you know. Okay, we're going to have layers 1 and 2. There's such a thing as the American National Body. The American National was, no. And people started yelling, and Leonardo yelled back at them, and the U.S. National Body filed a whole bunch of objections up the I2 ladder, and the France National Body filed objections on both sides, which was very interesting. A couple of people said things they shouldn't have. A couple of other people yelled at them. This was all done in German surroundings, so there were beer mugs waved all over the place. And there were lawyers involved eventually, of course, because that's the scheme of things. Well, what's the result? Hey, let's have a layer 3 and 4. But we have to use the filter bank from layers 1 and 2 because it's the perfect filter bank and we have papers to prove it. So, well, it doesn't have enough signal processing gain because aside from the perception, you have to handle the signal processing gain. You want all the free bits you can get, right? Well, they didn't think so. Their advertisement said, don't use layer 3. It has too much gain, which is logic for you. It reminds me of some political races. Anyhow, what do we do? So let's use a hybrid filter bank. We came up with a layer 3 and a layer 4. Our layer 3, we decided, was stillborn, so we just went straight to what we call layer 4, which became layer 3. And then there was a couple other layer 3s introduced, at which point we went up to layer 4 and back and forth and back and forth. And eventually, sure enough, we wound up having layer 3, which is what our original layer 4 was. So if that confused you all, well, okay, it's not your fault. So now the hybrid filter bank. There's a couple things you can say about a multi-stage filter bank. The first thing you can say is it has to have a longer impulse response than it really needs to have. It's a mathematical requirement. It's not a guess. It's a fact. You can't get around it. It has worse frequency rejection than it has to have. Again, you can't. It's, if you will, it's the law. You can't do it any other way. And it takes a lot more operations than doing it the right way. Nonetheless, using the hybrid filter bank, the same coder aspect using the hybrid filter bank was not too complicated. Never mind the original coder not using the hybrid filter bank that took considerably less complexity and implementation was too complicated. You figure it out. So we had layer 3. There was definitely lots and lots and lots of beer mugs waved. I can tell you that for sure. Lawyers claiming they own this, lawyers claiming we own this, lawyers claiming they own it. Since I don't work for any of the companies, I just won't name any of them. But that was interesting times. And there was a debacle involving the joint stereo coding. They decided early on that joint stereo coding was a bad thing because the IRT said so. And then the IRT found out that, lo and behold, their coder didn't sound as good as ASPEC, so they had to insert joint coding, but ASPEC wasn't allowed to have it. Right. Well, we got it in too, and such is life, but that's the standards. That's how MPEG works to this day. Anyhow, so what happened? Why is there an AAC? Well, layer 3 was finishing. The layer 1 and layer 2 people were done. They're part of the standards written. So they went off and they decided they were going to do a multi-channel version because layer 1 and 2, all of MPEG 1 is only stereo. And they decided it had to be backward compatible. And that meant you send a down mix and left and right. And then there was an ancillary data field. And they said, well, we'll put the other three more coded things in the ancillary data field. And basically use some differencing and so on. And this should only cost us 40 kilobits per second more than just sending the 5 channels independently. And it costs more because you have the coding noise. You have to cancel the coding noise out. Well, yeah, you could argue that. Went home and did a little bit of running things for MATLAB. We had a couple of choices. Either 40 kilobits per second was the extra burden, or linear algebra is correct. And I'm sorry, but you can't have both. And to this point, how many people use MPEG-2BC, the backward compatible codecs? Does anybody know they exist? Have you used it?
Not personally, but I believe they were technically allowed on European DVDs.
Well, actually, that in fact wasn't the backward compatible. That was the independent 5-channel version of it, which they introduced in a big hurry to try to scare off the next slide. And it's always nice to find appropriate clip art. What did AT&T do? Well, AT&T did a bunch of things, but I dropped out of the standards process. You know, I couldn't make that fly, and I was pretty sure it wasn't me. So Annibal Ferreira and I sat down and worked on a new codec, started from ground up, using an MDCT, using a stereo coding algorithm that made sense instead of the one that got stuck in Dampeg 1. And one of the things at Layer 3, which had been a bone of contention, is that it made an assumption that that most of the signal energy would be at low frequencies. And then Glockenspiel came along, and it didn't sound so good. Well, I just made a bit stream that didn't assume anything. Wherever the bits went, the bits went. There was no assumption. And we called this PAC for Perceptual Audio Coder. And a bunch of other things happened, which I don't, has nothing to do with audio coding. And then MPEG got around to a test. Now we had, I wasn't the only person that said, whoa, that doesn't look good. So MPEG finally said, we have to have a validation test. We want one non-backward compatible coder so that we can prove backward compatibility is good. And some of our friends said, oh, well, we're the only ones. We're the only people to have anything. And I said, well, actually, there's two. There were some arguments, but there were two coders, finally, two non-backward compatible coders put into the test. And in that test, Pat came in an easy first. The other independent five-channel coder came in an easy second. There was a nice statistical separation between first and second. And those were running at 320. Layer 3, running at 640 kilobits, came in a distant third with the backward compatible version. So you see, we can once again say that, yes, linear algebra actually works. Now, in fact, if you have a stationary signal, you can get away with the 40 kilobits, but how many people here listen to a constant drone in their audio? I mean, that's the problem. When you have any time domain issues, the masking may require you have 90 dB suppression of a pre-echo, and if you have a 10 millisecond block, you know, 90 dB is what? Oh, about 15 bits, and when you're running at 1 bit per sample and suddenly the next block requires 15 bits per sample, you know where you're at? Anyhow, so what happened is the backward compatible coders did not pass the validation test but were carried on to standard anyhow because we have to have this fast, which is, by the way, the reason that you have the stuff in the European DVDs. However, the first thing they did is they said, you know, we don't have to send this in backward compatible form because they send the matrix along with it. So they took the matrix, they zeroed the matrix, so the BC with a zeroed matrix, which means it's now independent five channels, is what's in the European DVDs. And so the non-backward compatible, or NBC project, got started. So that group that didn't get along, that came in first and second, which is to say AT&T and the people you would normally think of as doing five-channel coding in the U.S., and Fraunhofer, who came in with Layer 3, were all put together in a group and said, here, you guys have to cooperate and come up with something. And then Japan stuck up and said, whoa, we want a piece. So we had four people. And there was a long, drawn-out three-year process, but I'm two slides from the end, and my voice is letting out, so we'll just go there. Well, first, what happened? PAC won the NBC startup test. At that point, a whole bunch of other people got very agitated. They ran ASPEC against it for the test for the reference model, basically MP3 being ASPEC with a hybrid filter bank. So they took out the hybrid filter bank, doubled the length of the filter bank, and there was some other interesting machinations, but it won the hybrid, it won the reference model. And then we proceeded to have a whole bunch of experiments wherein pretty much every piece of ASPEC was yanked out of the coder and pretty much every piece of PAC was put right back into it. And then it was all renamed AAC because obviously there's a company out there that probably would object to an audio product called MDC. At least they're still in business this week. And the end, well, you never know what's going to happen when you try to break a compiler. And I love this Alan Sherman quote because it so applies to the standards bodies. I'll just let you read it yourself because I can't do Alan Sherman justice. And having said that, that is basically how MP3 came to be, at least from the stuff that I could see. know. I can give some answers, but is there any questions? Yo.
You asked me to ask you about scaling and test.
Oh, yeah. This is an interesting thing about the MPEG test. If you look at the quality of the stuff in the first MPEG test, the stuff that got a 4 out of 5 on the CCIR scale, which was just the passing grade in the first MPEG test, would have come in below 2 on the last MPEG test just because of listener training. It's one of these things you always have to watch out for with anything that puts in an unnatural sort of distortion, because you don't hear it at first. You don't know what to listen for. And then one day you hear it. And then once you hear it, you can't make it go away. It's stuck in your ear forever. But it's interesting to have, I mean, it's like you've heard of the Suzanne Vega problem. Some of you maybe. The very first MPEG test, 64 kilobit mono, Suzanne Vega was coded just in mono at 64 kilobits per second. And it sounded pretty good. It didn't quite get 4.0, which is why the codec didn't get released in the very first test. And then they did the second test, and they did it in stereo, and it was down around 2. And this actually wasn't learning. This is something that shows very clearly that 2 good mono coders don't make a good stereo coder, because when you introduce the spatial aspects, you get spatial unmasking. And what happened is Suzanne Vega is almost mono. That track is almost mono, just enough different that the coder puts in different noise in the two channels, which means that the sound image is straight in front of you, noise images at the sides, and you hear this stuff going on at the sides. So that was what led to some of my comments about the joint coding debacle, the stereo coding debacle in MPEG-1. Layer 3 has a stereo coding method which fixes Suzanne Vega, but pretty much nothing else in the face of the planet. Well, MP3 is either, it can either, in each block, it can either do MS or it can do LR. Okay. But it's for the whole block. AAC is on a per scale factor band basis, so you can do MS in some bands, LR in some other bands, and you can actually do intensity steering in other bands, and you can mix and match however you need to. And this, because each one of those is appropriate for a given class of signal, that works a lot better. Over there.
So the image processing folks have Lena. Is there a canonical test subject in the audio coding space?
Well, there's not one. You have different things that excite different artifacts. Castanets is really good. The Squam disk?
The AAS disk that you help?
No, not the AAS disk, the Squam disk. It's something put out by the EBU. There's a castanets, recording a castanets on it, which is death on pre-echo. There's track 40, which is a harpsichord, which is pretty much death on coding gain, because you can get, you have ring notes and an attack, and you can get these really interesting thwacks on the attack if you don't get the block switching right. There's German male speech, which has something called co-articulation release. Reichhuter has an album titled Jazz, and the first 30 seconds or so of the last track have a hammered dulcimer, which pretty much causes any kind of not correctly operated joint stereo to just collapse. Sounds a lot like that, actually. So there are a number of canonical tracks. It depends on what you're looking for. There is a shortage of test tracks that have independent, in the multi-channel space, there's very much a shortage of test tracks that have independent reverberation in the channels. As a result, a lot of the multi-channel tests have been done in a way that really was a real easy test for the five-channel stuff, because it was pan-potted, and replacing a pan-pot with a pan-pot works pretty well. For instance, the MPEG surround encoder has real trouble with this one thing called an applause thing, which was recorded in an audience with a microarray that I worked on at AT&T. And it has completely independent signals in five channels. And it pretty much causes MPEG surround to just roll its eyes up. It causes, by the way, it causes the Dolby ProLogic decoder to choke. The neural decoder chokes not quite as much. It's an example of why 5225 systems can't work for general material. And there's a lack of that material, so if anybody would like to make some independently mic stuff for 5 or 7 channels, that would be great stuff to have, especially if it's either public domain or got a research usage license so that everybody can use it for test. And if anybody wants to do that, I can sit and talk to you afterwards and tell you how to make some. But it's a good question, because for multi-channel, we're still lacking good test material. Yeah, Rick?
Was there some sort of justification for you to be studying this at AT&T? Or did you have carte blanche to do what you wanted?
Well, in this particular case, I was already working on music coding, and they said break the computer. So that's how it got started. Of course, once it got started, then everybody else got their mitts into it. But, you know how that works. Yeah. Well, you did notice that the ultimate comment here was a comment about a committee. There was no, yeah? Well, WMA is a proprietary system that actually, even if I worked at Microsoft for 6 years, I don't know very much about how it works. It is a perceptual codec, there's no question. I can tell you from the rate quality trade-offs, it's got a longer maximum block length, but I can do that from first principles. But that, it seems to do okay at joint coding, but you'd have to ask one of the people that invented it, and they probably have to kill you after they told you. I was audio architect. I didn't actually touch coding. I mean, I have a point of view. I think coding was pretty much done until somebody comes up with a whole new way. I think it was pretty much done in 97, 98, 99. I mean, we can come up with all these approximations to have worse quality at lower bit rates, but that worse quality at lower bit rates isn't my own. I'd rather get higher quality at higher bit rates myself. Questions? I saw another hand back there. Oh, yeah?
Do you do any work on dithering, super bit mapping, or do you have any opinions about how to go from 24-bit to 16-bit, like UV22, or I'm thinking of super bit mapping or any other manufacturers?
I have looked at some of that stuff. To tell you, my conclusion is that in the normal listening room, TPD is as good as anything else. Noise shaping is okay if you put in noise shaping, but if you put in noise shaping, you have to still have to dither something even if you put in noise shaping if you don't want to get tones. And if you noise shape, then by the definition of having storage in the noise shaping, you must, and this is not an option, you must have more total noise. I mean, it's one of these things about, when you have 5 fifth-order Delta-Sigma converters at moderate oversampling rates, they're a lot better. But if you go down in base no oversampling, they're actually worse, because the more storage you have, the more noise you keep around, so the more noise you have to cancel in the feedback loop. So I'd say it's 5 of 1, slightly less than 6 of the other. The main thing is you have to do something that resembles dithering, or it will be a problem. Anybody else?
Who's the lab?
It's not a lab. It's a yellow dog. That carpet's my living room carpet. Unless you're a dog treat, you have to worry about nothing but being licked to death. That sums up that dog in a nutshell. Yeah? I don't have a personal player. I hate wearing headphones. I'm a loudspeaker person. I don't have, I play CDs or multi-channel stuff that's been processed, and I'm playing it back in 20-bit converters, but it was 16 to begin with, so that says it all. No, I haven't, at this point, my position is if you're going to code stuff and you don't have to broadcast it, use DTS lossless, use FLAC, use lossless. I mean, perceptual coding, and let me show you the last slide, if I can find it, from the perceptual coding tutorial. It says, I'll point out, this is a comment that was made in 1988, and it still holds today. As soon as I find it, I only have like 60 tutorials on this thing. There we go. It'll take a minute to get it in. It's a large file. But we'll only do the last of the 90-some slides. That was my position in 1989. If you have enough bits, don't use it. Enough said? Because once you get beyond the final delivery, if you do any processing after the final delivery, you're going to get surprised. Bob?
So would you make this the usual obligatory statement about transcoding?
Don't.
Or re-encoding multiple passes in the same encoder?
That happens to be the slide immediately previous to the one you just saw. I moved one slide. But if you want to see the slide before that, I think that's a pretty clear statement. That is, by the way, the largest font size that was present in Office 97. I believe that. Does that answer your question? Anything else? Are we there yet?
I think we're there.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Watch the website for the Business of the November meeting. Question, how many of you actually go to the website regularly to look for stuff? Oh, good. You're not? Do you want to be?
Yes.
Send me email. There's a link on the website. And I'll make sure you get on. Anyone else? No? Okay. Good night. Good seeing you.
Thanks. So, what was your name again?
Bill.
I'm Ed.
Good seeing you.
Always. No.